Welcome to The B Word, a podcast about humans, organizations, behavior. I'm your host, James Healy. Don't forget to leave us a rating or a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. My colleagues, they study artificial intelligence. Me, I study natural stupidity. Apparently, so said behavioral economics pioneer Amos Tversky. It's a tongue-in-cheek comment that speaks to a far deeper truth. One that organizations will be well advised to heed as the breathless hype around AI becomes ever louder. Successfully adopting AI isn't about the technology. It's about the humans. And history shows that humans have a tendency to make things hard for ourselves. There's a strange paradox, first identified by Nobel Prize winning economist Robert Solow. The widespread adoption of computers has changed the world in many ways, but it doesn't seem to have had any impact whatsoever on productivity. Technology lets us do more, faster. But unless we do the right things, what's the point? With AI suddenly everywhere, it's a question that's more relevant than ever. Okay, Stuart, good morning. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Stuart, I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Before we get into the subject at hand, do you just want to give the listeners a bit of a professional overview of your areas of focus and your topics of expertise and interest?
Sure. So it's a by way of introduction as to who I am. My name is Dr. Stuart Mills. I'm an assistant professor of economics at the University of Leeds and a visiting fellow of behavioral science at the LSE. In terms of what I do and my professional background, my PhD, which was a few years ago now, was looking at personalization and personalization in behavioral science. I think it was one of the first projects to really focus on personalization, and it's a topic which is becoming more popular in the field. I finished that work, and elements of that work started leading me to think about data science and the role of data in behavioral science and technologies around personalization. Either way, I kind of parked the PhD for a while once I'd finished it, parked personalization and went to work on other things. But I kept getting drawn back in with new tech developments and being surrounded by some supportive, encouraging people that kept saying, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? And so a few years ago, I took the plunge and really embraced the term AI, which at the time, I don't think many people were talking about, and really started looking into the links between AI and behavioral science, AI and what I would call behavioral technologies in general. And I've been talking to people about it ever since. I dare say I do various other things, but that's like my main gig from a behavioral science perspective.
Awesome, thank you. I guess let's start with that intersection between AI and behavioral science. It's a question that I've been asked a few times. Why does someone who claims to have an interest and dare I say an expertise in behavioral science suddenly start talking about AI, other than the fact that everyone is talking about AI and it seems impossible to have a conversation in 2025 without talking about it? What sort of led you to that intersection? Do you want to go a little bit more into that? And I suspect we'll probably end up talking about Herbert Simon, because I've read a number of things that you've written that reference him.
Oh, I could talk about Herbert Simon all day, but that's just because I'm a nerd. Yeah, I've been thinking about this intersection quite a lot, because I, as you say, everyone right now is talking about AI, but it strikes me that behavioral scientists in particular are talking a lot about it and really interested in it. And it is a kind of open question as to why. And there are various affinities we could look at, and we could go down the Herbert Simon route and talk about some history, and I'd be happy to do that if you want me to. But I think the more recent discussions don't start from that place and don't ground it in history. I think it's more behavioral science, while it can be defined in all sorts of different ways, is really, at least from my perspective, trying to understand how people think and how people make decisions and how people take in information about the world and come up with some determination about what they're then going to do in the world. And artificial intelligence, at least as we currently have it, have built it in terms of kind of a fancy, really powerful data processing system, is kind of analogous to what people do. I don't want to say that AI thinks or AI works like how people operate, but it's kind of analogous to the same problem of you take in some information or some stimulus, you do something with it, and you make some judgment about what to then do. So I think behavioral scientists are in a good place to kind of naturally understand what AI does and how it could be applied. And because you can build AI systems which take over some elements of the decision-making process or could slot into various parts of the decision-making process, it naturally leads itself, I think, to behavioral science interventions, because behavioral science interventions, one way or another, are usually about trying to modify the decision-making landscape to influence people or to make decisions easier. And I can see naturally how someone could think, well, if we just get an AI to do this, or if we have an AI involved in the decision-making landscape, it could have positive benefits for people who have to make decisions. So I do think there are deeper links, though there's a deep history we could go into. But as a headline, I think AI naturally responds to an awful lot of how behavioral scientists already think and what behavioral scientists already do.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think you're probably right. It probably best serves the listeners if we don't have a nerd out about Herbert Simon. So instead, I'm going to ask you about something which has certainly been all over my LinkedIn feed in the last week. There seems to be another front in the culture war, which seems to be between those people who are aghast that Apple published a study last week saying that large language models don't think, and those people for whom this proves everything they thought, that AI is useless and it's all a sham. Without wishing to provide clickbait headlines, Dr. Stuart Mills says, do you want to help unpick that a little bit for the listeners?
Yeah, sure. I won't go too much into detail about what Apple did, in part because I don't think I could explain it well enough, though I do have an understanding of the approach. I also think it's interesting, I don't necessarily have a strong opinion on this, but I do think it's interesting that AI has become another sort of battlefield within the culture war, or is increasingly becoming so. And I will be upfront that I am generally more anti-AI than pro-AI. But certainly, the Apple paper hasn't demonstrated that AI is useless. And I think if someone is making that case, they are failing to see how these systems work. And I will very much defend the, to an extent, the beauty of modern AI systems and also the ingenuity of the engineering. The fundamental problem, I think, with AI from a cultural or societal understanding perspective is the name. And this goes deeper into, I don't think we as a group of people frequently talk critically about what does intelligence mean? What does it mean to be smart? In my opinion, intelligence is always sort of has a social context to it. I am called a smart person because I have a PhD, but ask my fiance, I am a moron, right? Intelligence has a social component to it. But I think people understand AI as if like, there is an amount of intelligence. The AI has got smarter because we've put more intelligence into the machine. Well, there isn't an amount of intelligence. Intelligence is not a quantum of anything. And we've not put more intelligence into it. So when Apple comes out with a paper that says, these machines don't think, they don't reason, they're not going through a process like a human being goes through, in my opinion, that's totally obvious, because I can look at how these machines work and I can understand the maths of it. And I'd say there is not an amount of intelligence to put in. But if you're just getting excited about these technologies, perhaps you're getting caught up in the hype, both generally okay, in my opinion. I don't think people need to be AI experts in this world. But if you've not thought critically about what intelligence is or dived a little bit into how these systems work, I can understand why it would suddenly seem surprising when you have a paper that says, well, these systems which you thought were thinking like human brains, actually they don't at all. And actually they are machines. And you put the machine in a setting that it doesn't understand and it breaks. That should be really obvious, but I don't think in the narratives that we talk about AI, that way of thinking comes through, which is why it leads to people saying, oh, this proves AI is useless. It doesn't. It just demonstrates that how most people think about AI is not a genuine reflection of how the tech works.
I would totally agree. And I was being a little bit cheeky putting you on the spot. Do you think that at the root of this is that we don't understand how people think? And that we tend to have a view of thinking, and as you say, of intelligence, that is very far from the reality and in some ways overstates human capabilities and in other ways perhaps understates them.
I feel like I'm putting myself in dangerous territory if I say we don't understand how humans think, because I think I get all sorts of professors coming around saying, well, you're just ignorant. But most of the models of human thought, which I think are often spoken about, or lots of the examples that are in behavioral science, while some of them can be very elegant and show some worthwhile results and things that we should think seriously about, they're almost always extremely simplified versions of actual cognitive processes. And something that I'm personally quite critical of behavioral science and psychology more broadly, though it's not my area of expertise, is behavioral scientists are pretty good at being able to describe and perhaps predict what choice a person might make in a very narrow setting, right? Apples or oranges. But when we talk about behavior, what we care about is how people exist in the world, right? How people exist over time and in a variety of settings. And that's extraordinarily complicated. And if you want to understand why I think a lot of behavioral science interventions often underperform, and also why I think AI applications are perhaps struggling to punch through, is because they both build from an intellectual foundation of, if we understand something really simple about people or about decisions, we can extrapolate quite a lot. But actually, decision-making and behavior becomes extremely complex extremely quickly. And I think we have a very, very limited understanding of how people behave, as I say, when defined as existing within the world.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And I think, as you say, and this isn't just an academic discussion about, you know, what happens in university psychology departments or in, you know, experimental settings, we tend to oversimplify the world and we tend to oversimplify, as you say, how we act in the world. And when you start to think about applying AI, I've had lots of conversations, and this predates the current AI kind of boom, but if you think about it in an organizational context, I've had lots of conversations at a really senior level where people will say, oh, well, it's easy. We just, you know, this process is we just take this information from over there and we do something to it and we send it over there. And at that sort of 30,000 foot level, yes, that process is really simple. But then when you talk to people who are actually doing the process, well, it's a lot more complicated because, well, we get this information from over here, except on a Thursday when there's a full moon, when we have to get it from over here because of some reason that you can't even imagine, or if it relates to this department over here, because then we have to go to Bob because they do it on paper. And it all boils down to the world is much more complicated than we imagine. And humans responding to that complexity are doing a lot more things than we imagine that we are. So trying to replace that with AI, there's some fairly obvious pitfalls there. Is that something you'd agree with? Is that something you've experienced?
I certainly agree with it. I might be misusing this word, but I believe physicists, when they talk about AI or systems, will often talk, will use the word fidelity. Basically, I might say the word plasticity, like how adaptive can the system be to random shocks and to errors? And modern AI systems, I think, give off the appearance of having high fidelity or high adaptiveness, because I can, if I put a prompt into ChatGPT, it'll give me an answer. And if the answer's not quite right, I can say to it, well, actually, the answer's not quite right. Can you change this, this, and this? And it will appear to change the output. It will appear to have high fidelity. But that's just in generating an output. And in the process you described with an organization, what you're actually looking at is a system where there will be imperceptible moments of someone adjusting this dial or changing this number or moving this file around. These natural things which people probably aren't even really consciously thinking about because they just seem obvious. And if it wasn't done, the system would break. And one of the great things about something being obvious is you can come up with a solution really easily. One of the bad things about something being obvious is it's really easy to overlook it. So AI, I think, is great. As you say, if you have this 30,000 feet level and all you care about is inputs and outputs, it can look like a really powerful tool. When you actually have to dig down into how organizations work, how processes work, you'll often find that you've ignored all sorts of minute behavioral considerations and wider considerations, which are essential to just ensuring everything works properly. I think this is tangential to the point you raised, but I think with discussion around things like AI agents, that's kind of my main criticism of them. It imagines processes as being really, really well defined, when actually I think most things that people do are probably really poorly defined. Like, we will have to find the input really well and the output really well and everything in the middle, it'll all click together. And I think that's where the major errors come from. I think that's why hallucinations are such an issue with these systems. I think it's why executives are very enthusiastic about AI. But if you actually look at how businesses are implementing it, they're often much more cautious, much smaller scale than the hype might suggest. And in some instances, companies are just not allowing AI to be used. So for instance, Microsoft's Copilot AI system, in the trial phase, businesses seemed to like it for PowerPoint, seemed to like it to an extent for Word, but no one was letting it anywhere near Excel. And the reason is, the accountants use Excel, and if you mess up your accounts, you've screwed your organization. So these sorts of things show a lack of fidelity in the system. And I think we should be more positive about talking about how humans are great at adapting to randomness and errors and just fixing things on the fly.
You recently published a paper, which I believe is called Efficient Inefficiency, which is a great title. Do you want to talk a little bit about what's in that paper and how that relates to what we've been talking about? Because I think there's a good segue there.
I'm glad you think it's a good title. I like it as a title, but it's kind of a tricky concept to explain, and I'm not sure efficient inefficiency is a great way of explaining it. The paper's main premise is AI will only be useful to an organization, or as an economist, we might say boost productivity, if AI is used to do useful things. And that sounds like such a obvious statement. Why does it need to be said? But with my economics organizations hat on, my managerial economics hat on, my behavioral economics hat on, there are loads and loads of examples of organizations doing things which have no value proposition to them, that don't actually make them more productive. To give perhaps a more behavioral perspective on these things. So I'm sure many listeners will have heard the term bounded rationality. It's a very foundational term in behavioral science. It just means that we have limited cognitive processing ability. We can't think about everything. We have to think about a narrow slice of what we've got available. Well, that idea came about through studies of organizations and how managers make decisions. And bounded rationality, when applied to organizations, says, well, managers have all sorts of problems going on. They can't manage every crisis. They've got to prioritize their cognitive resources to solve the most serious things. And the way they do that is they often let the less serious problems slide. They'll give a junior colleague you know, time off when they shouldn't have time off, or hire someone who you don't really need to hire, but it solves an easy problem because you need to prioritize something else. And so over time, because we're cognitively limited creatures, organizations gain this sort of layer of inefficiency where tasks are being done and nobody quite knows why, and they don't quite fit into productive processes. And so there's perhaps a controversial statement, but I would say every organization has, to a lesser or greater extent, this layer of inefficiency. Every organization is inefficient. And once you accept this, this argument that AI needs to be used to do things that are productive rather than unproductive becomes more obvious, because AI might be applied to do a task that no one actually needs doing. The reason we highlight it and we talk about it in terms of efficient inefficiency is I have a sneaking suspicion that most of the ready, obvious applications of artificial intelligence are to these tasks which do not contribute a lot of value to organizations. To give you a couple of examples, there's been a couple of studies looking at how AI helps programmers write code. And the headline of these studies is AI helps programmers write more code. If you measure productivity in terms of the amount of code written, AI is great. But then you dig down into the numbers and the code that's being written is really bad. And these programmers are spending substantially less time actually writing effective code and much more time fixing broken code. But that's not efficiency enhancing. But it just looks like it is on the surface. Another example, this is quite close to my heart because I don't like performance reviews. There's lots of talk about using AI to automate performance reviews. And the argument is, well, a junior colleague will write up what they thought they did well to a more senior colleague. The senior colleague will read it and they'll come up with some objectives and pointers for the junior colleague to improve their performance. And when you think about a performance review in that way, it's just about producing a document that gets exchanged between people. And so AI can be used to do that, right? But let's assume performance reviews are actually productivity enhancing. The value comes from two people sitting down and having a conversation. It comes through interpersonal exchange. It doesn't come through sending an email back and forth and someone ticking a box in HR. The last example I'll give, I love this. I encourage your viewers, go and watch this advert. A few months ago, Apple put out an advert for its Apple Intelligence System. And the advert is, an executive walks into a boardroom and the boardroom's packed. He sits down and the boss or whatever says, "Hi, can you summarize this report for everyone in the room just so we're on the same page?" And obviously the guy's not read the report. And the whole shtick of the advert is he's going to put it into Apple Intelligence and get a summary very, very quickly. And it saves him time. It looks really productive and enhancing. Two things to point out. It's not productivity enhancing if you spent that time like playing video games rather than doing something important for the company, right? And we don't actually know what he spent the time that he wasn't reading the report doing. Secondly, presumably he's been employed by that company because he has some unique skill set or perspective which he can bring to the table, which no one else who has read the report would have thought of. But all the AI is doing is summarizing the report and putting back or spitting out all these points, which if you had actually read the report, you would already know. So these are not productivity-enhancing applications, but if you look at the marketing material on a lot of AI applications today, these are the kind of things we're being sold on. And it makes me really worried that there's going to be massive investments in AI, and 5 years down the line, everyone's going to be scratching their heads thinking, where's the benefit?
So I think this would be a wildly better podcast if I now vehemently disagreed with you and we had a debate. But the problem is, I have to agree with you on almost everything you said. We'll come back to performance reviews in a moment. But one of the use cases that I see most often, and it's partly because it's rammed down your throat now in whichever email service you're using, is this email summary. And essentially where we're going is, if I want to send you an email, I can just cough up some bullet points. I don't even have to write them. I can use the voice interface. And my AI will write me an email, which I send to you. And then your AI will summarize the email and could actually even respond. what was the point? Have you and I communicated? No. Has some data been exchanged? I guess it has. Some data has moved back and forward. Has either of us learned anything? Has our relationship developed in any way? What was the point? And very topically, it's amazing when the universe does this, about 2 hours before we started this conversation, I happened to see something online, which was actually a reference to some Deloitte paper from last year, or maybe even 2 years ago, but it was about using AI, specifically generative AI, in procurement. And as anyone who has had the immense privilege of responding to an RFP or participating in some giant procurement process knows, the only thing more painful than having to write a huge response to one of those RFPs is being the person on the other side who has to read the huge responses. So there is now apparently a boom in products which can help you both get AI to write the massive RFP response, but then also get AI to summarize the massive RFP responses that you've now got 10 or 20 of to read. And I think it's an amazing example of what you're saying. On the face of it, this is hugely time-saving, productivity-enhancing. But the question that has to be asked is, what was the point of any of it? Is there not just a simpler way that we can deal with this problem?
I've been scratching my head for a few years now trying to find the right language, and I still don't have it, but I think my argument would be something along the lines of, we have to get better at recognizing when problems are technical versus when they're behavioral. Because you can almost always find a technological fix to any problem you can come up with. But effective problem solving means you come up with a solution which solves the actual problem. And if the actual problem is behavioral, if it's you and your colleague in a different organization both writing too much because you've got regulations or you've got bosses which are demanding you write too much, that we can put technical fixes in place. We can use AI summaries. But the real solution is think about why this information needs to be communicated and what information doesn't need to be communicated. And if you come with an effective behavioral solution, the AI doesn't even become relevant. I know we said we won't get into head, but Simon, and we won't. But something I think is really, really important to emphasize is that this is the core observation of Herbert Simon 40 years ago. He was a pioneer of artificial intelligence. A lot of his research started in trying to understand organizations and then people and then computers. And in the 80s, he was writing papers about how AI is going to be used in organizations. And he's pointing out that people often misuse technology because they fail to understand the nature of the problem they're trying to solve. And I find it fascinating that both, as far as I'm aware, this has been ignored for 40 years, but also, and I don't mean to cast shade on some of my behavioral colleagues, I think it's widely ignored in behavioral science right now today because this is older stuff. It's not the newer, sexier behavioral science stuff, which attracts a lot of people in. But it's hyper, hyper important, I think.
I'm glad you did come back to Herbert Simon, because there's an example that I read somewhere in something in a blog post maybe that you wrote, and I've used this example a few times. I have tried to attribute you with this. There's an example which I think is from Herbert Simon's autobiography about the US embassy somewhere and their telex machines, which I think sums this up beautifully. Do you want to recount that anecdote?
Yeah, firstly, I'll reference it properly. It's not in the autobiography. For all my nerdy friends out there, he mentions it briefly in The Sciences of the Artificial, but it's in Administrative Behavior, the fourth edition. That's the last version he ever wrote. No behavioral scientist has read that book except me, by the way. So that's the proper referencing. So yeah, he has this story. He tells it differently every time. So I'm going to tell it how I think is narratively most attractive. He has this story of being involved with the US State Department, so the big foreign office in the United States. And it was back in the 60s or the 50s. The State Department received information via telegram, or it's kind of a modern-ish version of telegram. And whenever there was a diplomatic crisis, which would happen all the time because it was the Cold War, they would get overwhelmed with telegrams. And their printers, their teleprinters, couldn't print these messages out fast enough. And so information that decision makers needed to have now would be backed up for hours and hours and hours. Really, really critical organizational problem. I think it underscores what I mean by a technical fix versus a behavioral fix. Simon notes that the State Department adopted a technical fix. They bought more printers. Because if you double the number of printers, you double the amount of messages you can print in a given time. And it temporarily solved the problem. For a few months, people were getting messages faster. And then it stopped working again. And the problem came back and it was just a huge, huge backlog. And Simon notes that the reason it didn't work, and the reason it was never going to work, is because they needed to solve the behavioral problem of people sending information that didn't need to be sent, rather than the technical problem of printing all these messages out. Because 95% of whatever was being printed out was just being ignored. I love this example. It resonates very deeply with me. I won't name any names, but part of my professional career, I was involved in implementing a new IT system. The organization was spending millions of pounds to put this system in. It wasn't working at all. I ended up talking to some people and I discovered that one of the major reasons was a very important person at the company every month wanted a 1,000-page report about the business. And I just thought to myself, no one has ever read this report. Certainly the person that wants this report does not read it. But they were spending millions of pounds to generate this report that no one was going to read. And that example has just stuck with me.
I've got plenty of similar examples. I think it is an endemic problem across organizations. And I think something that you said before really resonated. In organizations, we tend to default to technical fixes. It's not just in the, you know, in the world of behavioral science that people don't look at these problems. Organizations almost never look for the behavioral solution. The technological solution is so seductive. We imagine that technology can solve every problem. And we are really blind to the other problems that it creates. As you talked there about the telex machines, I just couldn't help but think of email and Slack and Teams and WhatsApp, and everybody in whatever organization, whatever field they're in, now has far more channels to communicate with each other. Communication is now much easier than it's ever been. What happens? We all communicate much more. But are we really communicating? We send more messages. More information is exchanged. Does it lead to productivity? I'm not sure that it does. And again, going back in time, 30, 40 years, Robert Solow famously talked about, you can see computers everywhere except in the productivity statistics. And it's this perennial kind of macroeconomic problem. I'm in Australia, obviously, you're in the UK. Not a day goes by without politicians scratching their heads and talking about, well, how do we improve productivity? I think the slightly challenging answer to that question is to look at how much unproductive work is being done and how much time is wasted in organizations and you aggregate it up at a whole of economy level. How much actual working time contributes to the productive activity of the organization? And to go back to your example of performance reviews, which are a whole cottage industry, I suspect many of the listeners, if they stop and think, will be able to identify vast areas of their own organizations and vast areas, dare I say, of their own working lives that aren't particularly productive or aren't particularly useful. I think you refer at various points to David Graeber's work. I'm a big fan of various parts of his work, but the thing that he's most famous for is something called bullshit jobs. Do you want to just give a little précis of that and how that fits in with what we're talking about here? Because I think it's a really useful concept.
Yeah. So Ray Graeber's great on a lot of stuff. The idea of bullshit jobs, I think, is the thing that's cut through in his work most. A bullshit job, as Graeber defines it, is a job that a person does where the person does not feel they are contributing any value to society or to their organization. They might actively feel like their job is being harmful. Certainly, they as an individual feel alienated by their work. That's a very academic definition, but the examples it gives are often people who do things which probably don't need to be done. And it's a provocative term. Loads of people in the literature started debating it. And there are examples where you can maybe dispute it. But I agree with you. I think in my regular conversations with MBA students and with organizations, many, many people who have had a working career can identify elements of bullshit often in their own lives and in their wider organizations. And Graeber's methods are hardly sort of scientific and rigorous, but it's telling that when he started this research, a large minority, maybe 30-40% of people said, yes, my job is bullshit, or yes, my job consists of a large component of bullshit. And it does seem to be something that's quite endemic in the world of work, particularly in the developed economies today or post-industrial economies today.
Yeah, I think it's something that most people could identify with, if not their whole job, certainly a portion of it. And I think that raises an interesting question. If it is so well known, if it is so well recognized, why does it persevere?
I think there's a variety of reasons, and I perhaps take the conversation back to this technical fix versus a behavioral problem. From a often private organization perspective, and from the perspective of a senior manager in a private organization, it's often easier to spend money than it is to change behavior. It's easier to buy some technology or to hire a new person than to change behavior. And it's often hard to change behavior because the person's behavior that needs to change is that of the senior manager. If you're doing something that is unproductive, it's often because your boss is telling you to do it. If you have a senior position, if you have a degree of power, you probably want to hold on to that. You're probably not immune to sort of opportunities to learn and to criticism, but you probably are also a bit resistant to it when it's coming from people below you. So I think there's a lot of psychological force and personal motivations from a senior position to allow bullshit to persist. Because once you acknowledge bullshit, you've also acknowledged, oh, I created the bullshit, or I didn't spot the bullshit, or I've not effectively managed this person. You've got to take a degree of personal responsibility to accountability. I don't think in many organizational structures that is incentivized or desired by people. So that would be my speculation on organizational level. It's easier to spend money than it is to change behavior, and the behavior that often has to be changed is the behavior of someone who is powerful and in a position to insulate themselves from criticism and insulate themselves from change.
Yeah, I think that's very true. My experience would be there is a shocking lack of concern about whether or not things actually work. Many people in the private sector imagine that the private sector is inherently far more efficient than the public sector, and imagine that the profit motive will force efficiency, because people wouldn't continue doing inefficient things because, you know, that would make them more expensive, they'd lose market share, et cetera, et cetera. But I think so often, particularly around people, we don't try and measure success, or we measure success using very bad proxies. So again, I'll go back to your performance management example. The usual measurements around that are how many people have completed their objective setting, how many people have ticked the box to say they've had their performance review conversation. And there's then probably some kind of bell curve applied to the ratings that people have got to moderate. All too rarely, I suspect, certainly from what I have seen, is there any attempt to measure progress, to objectively measure, has performance improved? And the measures that are used are so inherently subjective. You know, your manager, perhaps in conjunction with other managers, perhaps not, gives you a 1-3 rating or a 1-5 rating or whatever. So we almost create this illusion of using data and having a rational, logical process, when actually we're not really assessing the right things. We're not really assessing if things work at all. It's just not a question that we care that much about, it seems to me.
Yeah, I have little evidence for this, but it's why my working hypothesis is AI will often be applied to these tasks, because these kind of tasks are often the things where we have a very easy, intuitive way of measuring whether they're being done or not, or how many reports are being filed. That's a very easy way of measuring productivity. How much code is being written, easy way of measuring productivity. And so I think AI applications get attracted to those more bullshit adjacent activities, because the activities in an organization which really contribute value are either, I think, rarely measured or much, much harder to measure. I do want to perhaps say some sort of economic defenses of my position. So you say it's widely believed that the private sector is more efficient than the public sector. I don't think it's helpful to distinguish between public and private, because I think all organizations suffer these same burdens, that as they become larger, as they exist for a long period of time, they accumulate this layer of bullshit, this layer of inefficiency, regardless of whether it's in the public sector or private sector. An economist might argue, well, in the private sector, you have all these competitive forces. So really inefficient businesses over time will fail, and therefore businesses can get rid of their inefficiencies. But I just don't think this holds true. A business that is large enough can insulate itself from competition, and we see that quite regularly with the large technology companies we have today. If every business is inefficient, then you're never going to get hyper efficiency. It can be costly to identify inefficiencies, right? If I decide to go and audit Apple for how efficient it is, or Google, it's going to cost them enormous amounts of money because they're massive businesses. And if it's more expensive, if it's cheaper to let the inefficiency last, it will. So competition just does not erode these forces. And so we have to get better at understanding how organizations exist with them and how we can create solutions to solve these inefficiencies, and being a bit more candid about how the manager's job is not to create an efficient system, it is to control the spread of inefficiency, which is a different spin, perhaps a negative spin on things, but it's certainly not how modern management or modern leadership talks about running an organization. But I think it's essential to actually getting a grasp on what effective management and effective organization is.
I would agree. And I think there's this phrase that has become fashionable. I don't know if it originated with Amazon, but it certainly has become fashionable because of Amazon, because it's one of Jeff Bezos's 15 or 20, whatever it is, principles. And the phrase is bias for action. Now, the phrase describes a very old human tendency. But I think particularly in organizations, doing something, demonstrating that you are doing something, is rewarded and recognized. It seems counterintuitive, almost countercultural, almost dangerous to suggest subtracting. And our instinctive response to any problem is to add people, add processes, add technology, add projects, add initiatives. Whereas actually, as you say, we will be far better off if we started by asking, well, what can we remove? And if the role of the manager were, well, to ask that question, what can we stop doing? What can we cut out?
Perhaps we tend to couch it in those terms, because I think that potentially leads to a line of destructive cost cutting. And that's always something to keep in mind. It's something I've thought about quite a lot. This bias towards action, because I'm sure you'll have seen it. I'm sure listeners will have seen it. Whenever a new person enters a management position, they will almost certainly initiate some sort of review of systems, or they'll have some new strategic action plan or something like that. They will do something. And I often wonder why. And I perhaps cynically come to the conclusion the action is used as a way of justifying their position. If they're not acting, then why are they there? And it creates these inefficiencies. So I really do think that's important. And perhaps managerial education that does have a bent towards thinking about cutting or thinking about subtracting, thinking about being leaner is an important component. As I say, I'm worried about emphasizing cost cutting because I think a lot of management education in the past couple of decades really has, and it's that also has not been helpful. My preference is to emphasize that we manage inefficiency rather than we manage efficiency, to kind of acknowledge that inefficiency always exists rather than delude ourselves into thinking that there is an efficient plateau that we can reach. I also would add, maybe because this would be interesting from a behavioral perspective, if we go back to Simon, he talks an awful lot about information, and he really puts it in the terms of organizations have developed for so long in an information scarce environment. The dawn of the computer has radically changed that. Now we have an information abundant environment. And he talks about what he calls the information fallacy, that people want information because it makes them feel safe. It makes them feel good. It makes them feel in control. And we're, as a species, not well adapted to effectively managing the amount of information that we use because we're biased towards wanting more. It makes us have all these positive feelings, but in the long run, that's just adding bloat to the system. And so I wonder if from a behavioral science perspective, we should spend a bit of time trying to understand this information fallacy or this information bias, because I certainly believe it exists and it's driving so many applications of AI and proposed problems which AI is a solution to.
Yeah, I really like that. I have to say my fear is that AI is going to supercharge the bullshit machine. It's going to enable us to produce vast amounts of information, vastly more than we already can. And I think if you ask most people in 2025, they would say that they're overwhelmed by information, they're overwhelmed by communication. I fear that in 5 or 10 years, we will look back on this as the halcyon days of minimal information. Don't you wish it was like it was in 2024 when, you know, you only got 300 emails a day? But I've somewhat laid my cards on the table there. I want to finish by asking you to do that thing that all behavioral scientists hate doing, which is to make a prediction. How do you think this will play out? Do you think we're going to supercharge the bullshit machine with AI, or do you think that we're going to usher in a new dawn of thinking more carefully about organizations and thinking more carefully about behavioral rather than technological solutions to problems?
I'm certainly not that optimistic. I think AI applications are probably here to stay, but if I were to make a prediction, I think we've probably reached a saturation point in terms of applications. Certainly, if you look at a company like Microsoft, it is building a business plan of, we will sell professional software, we will package AI into it, we will get our software to be an essential part of your organizational ecosystem, and therefore you can't ever really detach yourself from us. And our AI systems will become embedded in your organization, and so you'll continue to use them. But I don't think AI is going to proliferate an awful lot more than what it currently does. Summarizing reports, dealing with emails, maybe automating some production, chatbots, things like that, that's the low-hanging fruit. And I don't see how AI kind of climbs up that tree to more valuable positions. So I think in terms of applications, we've probably peaked, the famous last words. I also wonder whether the AI landscape is going to continue being dominated by a few large players, or as some companies like SAP have started doing, whether large language model style systems are going to become much more bespoke and engineered by the organizations themselves. I could potentially see some benefits of each organization creating its own large language model rather than outsourcing it to OpenAI or Google or whatever. But I think the tech is here to stay. My last sort of prediction, I guess I would say, is I would not be surprised if in the next few years we see some sort of management innovation to try and guarantee that people have actually read reports, or some sort of quasi-hacking style development in email etiquette to try and guarantee that someone has actually read your email. And this is just like more technical fixes to problems which are ultimately behavioral. But this is kind of how organizations develop. So that's what I'd expect. AI is here to stay. It will be used to an extent, and then people will innovate ways to kind of try and cut out the bad results that using AI inevitably creates.
I love it. We'll essentially have an AI version of the old classic from school days of writing some rude non sequitur in the middle of an essay to check if your teacher is actually reading it. I think that's a kind of AI future that we can all embrace. Stuart, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you. Really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me.
That conversation surfaced some uncomfortable truths about organizational life. When you stop to think about it, I bet you spend lots of your time at work doing things that have questionable value at best. Tick box mandatory e-learnings, a needlessly convoluted performance management process, an array of ineffective meetings that eat up time and create no tangible output other than more meetings. Producing reports that no one actually reads. The never-ending battle to stay on top of your inbox. How much of this really adds to the productive output of you or your organization? But as Stuart said, it's much easier to spend money than it is to change behavior. It's much easier to chase the latest shiny thing than to do the hard, unsexy work of fixing processes or fixing data. The promise of a new technology to magic all of this away sounds seductive. But does it really make sense? Wouldn't it be better to stop the time-wasting performative nonsense and use AI for something a bit more useful? Henry Ford apparently said that if he'd asked customers what they wanted, they'd have said faster horses. For all of AI's undoubted potential, it strikes me that at the moment, much of what we're seeing is faster horses. Giddy up.
You've been listening to The B Word.